Accession number 17771, Reel 4.
Right, as I was saying, we were very well organised, and this was, I suppose, by the end of September, we were flying round the clock, but you had slots. You'd take off at whatever time your slot was, with your landing time in Berlin. We all used Gatow, the Americans used Tempelhof, and during the time the airlift was on, another airfield at Tegel was built in the French zone, and that was eventually used mainly by the Hastings. You would take off and fly from beacon to beacon, making sure that you were on your time, plus or minus 30 seconds I spoke about. Before you reached Berlin, you would call up with your call sign and with your load, coal, food, or whatever it happened to be. And then on the final beacon, you would have to be on time, and then you would land, taxi into a long line of waiting aeroplanes. As soon as you'd stopped your engines, lorries would draw up. German loaders and unloaders would appear. You would go off to a coffee bar facility and have about 10 minutes for a cup of coffee. And you'd be off the ground again, probably, in a great queue of aeroplanes, within about 20 to 30 minutes of having landed. The route back was much shorter. You would land and presumably have some food and wait until the second your second wave was ready, and then you'd fly on that wave, and that would be the end of your trips for today, probably taking 5-7 hours depending. And then you were off until the next wave. But that was constantly varying, so you would fly so many daylight trips, and then you'd move into a night sector and so on. And there were various systems devised during the course of the airlift. I remember one of our navigators had been a London Passenger Transport Board bus scheduler before the war, and so he was brought in to devise a schedule. And I remember they put up about three different schedules, all very democratic, all providing the right number of aircraft to go to Berlin, but with different crew schedules, and we were able to, as it were, vote on the one that we liked most. We had no days off, really, during the time that we were at Wunstorf, but every now and then an aeroplane, and bear in mind that these aircraft were flying way beyond the sort of hours that they were designed to take, so it meant far more frequent deep servicing. That couldn't be done in Germany. And so we used to fly our aircraft back to the UK every now and again, and this gave the opportunity for every crew to have 6 or 7 days leave in the UK. And there were all numerous contractors around the country who'd been contracted to do the deeper servicing of the aeroplane, because I think Royal Air Force engineers were stretched to the limit just keeping the aircraft flying. Some of them were quite small airfields. I remember we used to air service training at Hamble, where I subsequently, strangely, went to work a few years later, was one of those airfields. It was a small grass airfield, and you could only take a York in or out of there, providing the wind was, if I remember, about southwesterly, at least 15 knots. But that was one of the places where we used to have our aircraft serviced. So you would get 5 or 6 days leave, and then you were back, bringing one of the aeroplanes which had been serviced back, and you would join in the great rigmarole of going on flying. It was, of course, the most enormous success. The point, I'm heavily involved in the commemorations for the 50th anniversary of the airlift, which start this year, as I'm the vice president of the British Berlin Airlift Association. The Germans, of course, have been immensely grateful for this airlift. And it was interesting from our point of view, I think in particular, that here we were, I should think 80% of the crews flying on the four-engined aircraft during the airlift had all been in Bomber Command. So only 3 years before, we'd been bombing Germany. And I can assure you, we all much preferred saving life to taking life. And so this business of feeding Berlin was something which we really took to. I mean, we felt it was a great necessity, it was a great thing to be doing. And of course it showed great determination on part of the Western Allies, political determination. I think that was the important thing. We had a job to do and we did it. But it was really our politicians who decided that they were not going to give up West Berlin. if they could possibly help it. Although it has to be said that when the blockade first started, there was considerable doubt about the authorities whether we could feed what were 2 million people for a period which nobody known, because it had never ever been done before. But there was an Air Commodore in Berlin, Air Commodore Waite, unhappily now dead, but his widow is a honorary member of our association, who believed it could, and he sold his ideas to General Robertson, who was the British commander in Berlin, who sold it to Cassius Clay, who was perhaps the better-known American commander in Berlin. He had put forward a plan of driving a convoy up the autobahns, because he believed that the Russians were not prepared to go to war. He may well have been right, but it was a fairly provocative thing to do, which nobody wanted to do. However, the proof of the pudding was whether the Russians would interfere with an airlift. And, of course, they never did. Yes, there were instances of aircraft being buzzed by Russian fighters, but it was no more serious than that. But having convinced the two generals, the generals convinced the politicians, led by that great man, I think one of our greatest foreign secretaries, Ernie Bevin. I was fortunate when I was still only a flight lieutenant, I think, but he came to Wunstorf and I met Ernie Bevin, a man of most tremendous personality and charisma. So I've always had enormous admiration for him. Because he was also, although I didn't know it at the time, he was the man who was really responsible for the Marshall Plan. General George Marshall had made this speech at Harvard in 1948, in which he said that one of the things that the Allies had to do was to reconstruct Europe. And of course, he didn't just mean Western Europe. The press hadn't taken it up, had ignored it. Ernie Bevin got a message from the British ambassador in Washington telling him about this speech, and he got up in the House of Commons and said, Britain will back this plan. And from then on, as you know, it was the most enormous success and did tremendous work in the resuscitation of Germany and France. Stalin, of course, didn't want to know about it. It was a Western idea, and as he had total control of the money, he wasn't going to join in, and so they lost out on it. So the airlift was a tremendous job and well worth doing, and of course it succeeded, and succeeded very well indeed. In the end, I think there must have been nearly 500 aeroplanes. Two-thirds of them were American and the rest were British. Even some civilian airlines had their early start. There were civilian Halifaxes, a thing called a Halton, which was merely a Halifax with a pannier underneath. All the liquid fuel was taken in by flight refueling, and in fact the famous Pathfinder Don Bennett flew these aeroplanes into Berlin carrying liquid fuel. And as people know, even the Sunderland was used, because a lot of salt is needed in a big city, and that was the only aeroplane which was actually able to carry salt without any damage to itself, because of course being a flying boat, it had been treated because of sea and salt air. It became tedious, I think, particularly once the blockade had been lifted. The Russians eventually gave up, and on the 12th of May 1949, the blockade was lifted. Of course, it took some time then for the trains, barges and lorries to get going. And also the Allies, having been caught with their pants down in the year before, were determined to build up sufficient stocks so that if the Russians, and who was to know, suddenly reimposed the blockade, there wasn't any catching up to be done. So the airlift itself actually went on until, I think, the last flight was about October. And, of course, once the excitement of the airlift, once the real excitement of the airlift had stopped, i.e. once the corridors were open, it became really slightly boring. And by that time, we were fairly tired. I actually stopped flying on the airlift in August because I became ill and had to have an operation. Nothing to do with the airlift, I hasten to add. And by that time, I had done 263 return trips to Berlin. And it had become very much a routine, as I say, rather like operating a bus or a train. But it had been and a very interesting and rewarding experience. The other thing that it had also done, I mean, service outfits like Air Force squadrons, etc., rely very much on the sort of companionship, the comradeship, if you like, which developed. When we were flying the routes out to India and Singapore, we never met anybody because, well, very seldom. If you were flying on the route, the rest of your squadron was either somewhere else on the route or back at base. When you were back at base, most of the squadron were flying away. So when we suddenly all came together at Wunstorth in June, July of 1948, it was the first time we had really been a squadron. And even throughout the airlift, we were all together. And so that sort of comradeship and friendship, which is so important on a squadron, had, if you like, been resuscitated. So from that point of view, it was interesting. It was tiring. We were all glad for our few days at home, which we got once every, I don't remember now, 6 or 7 weeks, perhaps 2 months, I don't remember. But it had been, as I say, a rewarding incident in one's life.
You said the order was that if you missed your slot for landing at Gatow, that you should go back. Did that actually happen?
Well, it happened occasionally. I mean, it would happen more usually if the weather was very bad and one hadn't got lined up. In the early days, we relied on an internal device to get the aircraft in bad weather. It was a beam approach system. It was a system on the airfield which sent out a beam. The navigator on his radar set interpreted that beam and talked the pilot down onto the ground. It was fairly good. The beam could occasionally get diverted through weather phenomenon or other things, but it was the first time that the ground-controlled approach, which is now something which has been used worldwide ever since, was introduced into Gatow, so we were being talked down from the ground. There were other occasions when perhaps one of the aircraft which was lining up for takeoff was a bit slow. And so you had to abort your landing in order not to land on him. But it was relatively, if I look through my logbook now, I suspect that I might find no more than one or two instances out of 260 instances.
Now, 1982 and the Falklands War, can you tell me about your own part in that, please?
Yes. I had been very fortunate in being appointed as the Air Officer Commanding No. 18 Group. This was the old Coastal Command under another name, and it was based at Northwood, where indeed Coastal Command always had been. In 1967, I mean, one of the things, of course, that came out during the last war was that in order to combat the submarine, it had to be a combined operation between the Navy and the Royal Air Force. And this is a lesson that had been well learnt. And in 1967, Commander-in-Chief, Home Fleet, as it had been known, moved his headquarters from Portsmouth to Northwood to be alongside Coastal Command. So the two commanders-in-chief sat next door to each other. So, and this had continued right up to when I was appointed as the CNC of 18 Group. So I worked very closely with my naval opposite numbers. Every morning, myself and the commander-in-chief fleet would appear in the combined briefing room, where we'd be briefed by naval and RAF officers on what was happening around the world. So it was a very close-knit organisation. And so I was actually in Hawaii presenting a trophy to an American coastal squadron who had won a trophy which had been presented by the Royal Air Force when the start, if you like, of the career of the Falklands War had been the arrival of these people in South Georgia, allegedly scrap metal merchants. And so when I got back to the UK, there was a fair amount of tension, if you like, in the air. And as you know, subsequently, the Argentinians invaded the Falkland Islands. The Commander-in-Chief Fleet was a very fine man called Admiral Sir John Fieldhouse, and he had become not only a colleague but a great personal friend. And so when the task force was being set up, he appointed me as the air commander in charge of all the Royal Air Force resources which were to be used for the Falklands War. And so I was, from almost day one, entirely involved in planning the war. We had what was known as a flare go, a flag and air and general officers meeting every morning in the CNC Navy's office, which consisted of the CNC and myself, who was also his deputy for the task force, his chief of staff, who was an Admiral Halifax, the FOSM, the Flag Officer Submarines, and Admiral Herbert, and the chief naval engineering officer. And so we would meet every morning to plan what was going on. Very often, during the course of the whole war, being joined either by the Prime Minister, the Minister of Defence, I remember the Prince Philip came on two or three occasions. And so it was a very interesting part of my career. At the beginning of the operation, of course, the Air Force was severely handicapped because defence policy for some years had maintained that we would never fight out of area, the NATO area, that is, without allies. Very little had been done to extend the range of our aeroplanes. Happily, we had two flight refueling Victor tanker squadrons, but not many of our aircraft had actually been made flight refueling capable until the war started. The Nimrod, for example, had not. So as the fleet sailed from the UK and reassembled at Ascension Island, which was the halfway staging post and an absolute key to the whole of the Falklands War, particularly the Air Force effort, it was wonderfully stationed, exactly 4,000 miles from the UK and therefore 4,000 miles from the Falklands. It had one good runway because the Americans had been using it. It was originally used as a staging post for aircraft coming from America to Africa during the war, but had been used as a downrange facility for Cape Canaveral, or Cape Kennedy as it came to be, for missile testing. So the Americans built this fine facility and had a few buildings, etc., there, because the RAF really hadn't used it at all. So, however, it was a British island, and the Americans, of course, were marvellously supportive and helpful throughout the war. Once the fleet had assembled there and the command team had flown down to have discussions about the next stage of the game, because no decision had been made about what happened when the task force got to the Falkland Islands until it was really over halfway there. But at that time, we had no aircraft which could probably fly more than about 1,500 miles south of the Ascension Island, so not much help. However, thanks to the ingenuity of our engineers and the speed of the aircraft industry, within literally 3 weeks, the Nimrods had been converted to flight refueling. They simply bored a hole in the roof above the pilot, put in a probe, which had been obtained from part of the Vulcan fleet, because the Vulcans all had flight refueling probes but had never used them. They ran a Bowser hose from where the probe was put along the floor of the cabin to the back of the aeroplane, where it exited into two of the tanks at the rear. So it was a real Heath Robinson affair, but worked marvellously. And so the range of the Nimrod was extended overnight to really as to how many tanker sorties you could afford to give them. It meant that eventually, when the fleet were down off the Falklands, we were able to send reconnaissance missions right down to the Argentinian coast to see what the Argentinian fleet were up to. We were not to know, of course, that once we'd sunk the Belgrano, the Argentinian fleet never put to sea again. So that was the first and most important of the work that was done on aeroplanes to make them available. Meantime, of course, the key to the whole operation was the Sea Harrier, and we only had about 25 of those, and we had the Hermes and we had the Invincible, the two aircraft carriers, or one was a, they were both not fixed wing aircraft carriers, but they had Harrier, Sea Harriers embarked. The key was that we had too few of them, and we were very concerned about any attrition rate we might suffer, not only from enemy action, but also, of course, from bad weather, accidents, etc. So number one squadron, and I think this is really quite a remarkable story, number one squadron, which was our premier Harrier squadron, which was based in Germany, about as far from the sea as you can imagine that you can be, whose role in life was support of army units in the land battle, was overnight turned into a backup Sea Harrier squadron. The crews were trained to operate off a flight deck with its landing system. The aircraft were modified in a number of ways to be able to be used at sea. They hadn't been, if you like, sea-proofed as ordinary land-based Harriers, and that had to be done to try and protect them from the ravages of salt water. And as I said, the crews had to be turned from being ground attack pilots into fighter pilots. And the aircraft had to be modified to take sidewinder missiles, because that was the role, which was not their major role, which we needed. They had to back up the fighters that we had down south. They were then flown down to Ascension Island when, in the remarkably short time, but they were not in time to go straight on board the carriers. They were put on board the Atlantic Conveyor, which was one of the many ships that had been taken up from trade and converted. And this was a remarkable ship in many respects. It was, of course, unhappily sunk in the end, but not before all the Sea Harriers had moved on to the proper aircraft carriers. The other aircraft that we needed to keep the fleet supplied down south, and not just with mail but with spare parts, was the Hercules. And so the Hercules, like the Nimrod, was converted to be able to do flight refueling. Furthermore, because we only had these two tanker squadrons, we were also able to convert one or two of the Hercules into tankers themselves so that they could actually give fuel as well as take it on. And this enabled some remarkable sorties by our Hercules aircraft from Ascension Island, delivering mail and spares to the fleet off the Falkland Islands. And some of those sorties actually took 24 hours. The Nimrod sorties took 19 hours when they were extended all the way down to the Argentine coastline. So there was a fair amount of extremely long-range flying going on. And they both did their job, I think, quite remarkably. One of the most remarkable, I think, reinforcements, of course, when our Harriers got down to the Falkland Islands, the Sea Harrier had really done its job insofar that they hadn't lost very many aeroplanes. They had dealt with large numbers of the Argentinian Skyhawks and Mirage, and so our Harriers, in the end, were actually used for their original role, that was ground attack and support. We lost two of those aeroplanes. In order to back them up towards the end, we actually sent four more Harriers down to the fleet. And I think this is not well known, but one of the more remarkable operations, because we literally flight refueled these four Harriers from Ascension Island all the way down to a small speck bouncing around in the South Atlantic with these single-seat aeroplanes. And I must say, the Navy, bless their socks, thought I was mad, And so there was considerable trepidation when I sent these aircraft off. I think it was one of my most uncomfortable period of hours waiting for these aircraft to arrive safely down south, which of course they did. But it was a remark. They had nowhere to go in between. There was the odd British ship in the middle of the Atlantic somewhere, but whether they'd ever found it, God alone knows. They were accompanied for most of the way, at least half of the way, by a tanker aeroplane. But that could have done no more than give them fuel, or if they'd had an engine failure or something, pinpoint where they'd actually gone in. But I was happy to say that it all happened, it happened well, and they arrived. I think one of the most remarkable and most misunderstood of the RAF operations during the Falklands was the Vulcan raids on Port Stanley Airfield. In one of the things that was most important to us as the commanders during the Falklands was the Port Stanley Airfield, which was quite small and could not take modern frontline fighters. And we were determined that the Argentinians should never be able to operate either their Skyhawks or more particularly their Super Entendeur airplanes with the Exocet missile from Port Stanley. And to do so, they'd have had to extend the runway, and we wished to discourage that. We had tried using Sea Harriers, lobbing bombs at the airfield, but a very inaccurate and fairly useless way of attacking an airfield. People, I don't think, understand the enormous weight of bombs which is actually required to put an airfield out of action. A long, slim runway, even with fairly modern methods, is not easy to attack. And I think if you'd done the sort of sums that Air Force planners do, you would reckon that you probably had to put about 40 or 50 aircraft over the airfield, all armed with 10 to 20,000 pounds of bombs in order to guarantee that happening. Well, of course, there was no possible way that we